We continue Reverend Dr. Wilda C. Gaffney's Women, Girls, and the Divine Feminine in Hebrew and Christian Scriptures. A few weeks ago, we read the lesser known story of King Saul's daughter, Michal, who was given in marriage to the shepherd musician turned warlord, David. Today, we hear more about two of David's other wives and the treatment of foreign women during times of war. First Samuel 27, verses 1 to 2 and 8 to 12. David said in his heart, "Now one day I shall be swept away by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better than that I escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any further within the border of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand." So David got up and went over, he and 600 men who were with him, to Achish, son of Maok, ruler of Gath. And David stayed with Achish at Gath, he and his troops, each man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, wife of Nabal. And David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Jersites, and the Malachites, for they were the inhabitants of the land from of old, on your way to Shur and on to the land of Egypt. Then David smote the land, and there was neither woman nor man living, and he took cattle and sheep and donkeys and camels and clothing, and would return and come back to Achish. Then Achish would ask, "Against whom did you all raid today?" And David would say, "Against the Negeb of the Kenites." Neither woman nor man David left living to be brought back to Gath, saying, "Lest they tell about us and say, thus did David." Thus was his custom all the days he lived in the land of the Philistines. Achish trusted David, saying, "He has made himself an abhorrent stench in the nostrils of his people in Israel. So he shall be my slave for all time." Matthew 18:10-14. "Take care that you do not despise one of these little ones. For, I tell you, in heaven their angels continually see the face of my Father in heaven. What do you think? If a shepherd has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I tell you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So it is not the will of your Father in heaven that one of these little ones should be lost." The witness of modern wisdom, Teresa of Calcutta. The child is the beauty of God present in the world. God is still speaking.
And we are still listening. Thanks be to God. Thank you.
Will you pray with me?
Merciful God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our help and our Redeemer. Amen.
It's good to be back with you again this morning. We've had a lovely couple of days after a really lovely week as an ecumenical worship last Sunday. But it's good to be back in the pulpit this morning and wrestling with these stories alongside you. Year W has raised a number of stories that are rarely told throughout our regular cycle of readings. And for the past few weeks, we've been reading these stories that surround the story of David, the king, the shepherd boy turned king. We read about Michal. She was the daughter of Saul, given as a wife to David to entrap him by Saul, to make him part of the royal family and to tie him in with Saul's lineage. Well, at that time, I also alluded to his other two wives, Ahinoam and Abigail. If you recall, Saul's view of David sours after he has this rise to popularity and power amongst the people. Saul's afraid that he might come and usurp him on the throne, with good reason. Saul's son Jonathan understands that Saul has it in for David. He cautions David, he's going to murder you, and so he flees. David and his men flee to the wilderness, to living in caves. Now, if you are an up-and-coming king, that is not a good look. You don't want to be living in caves. It doesn't look very powerful. So how do you make your old boss really mad? You join the competition. You go over to the other side, which is what David does. He joins his enemies, the Philistines. He joins Achish as one of his mercenaries. And it says, David smote them from evening till morning, and there was neither man nor woman living. I confess, when I came across this passage in our Thursday morning Bible study, I didn't know exactly how I would find any good news in this text. Where is the gospel here? There's, of course, much more to this story. If you read back to 1 and 2 Samuel and you read in context, you'll understand that there's a cycle of violence that is going on throughout these people. It's tribal warfare that has continued on throughout this time. The Amalekites have raided David's camp. They've kidnapped these two women and carried them off with their livestock and clothing and everything else. So he didn't exactly just wake up one morning and decide to go genocide his neighbors. But this does not excuse the violence we read about in this story. A cycle of violence does not make it right to kill man, woman, and child. Wilda Gaffney preaches a sermon on this account of David's trail of destruction, and she entitled it Collateral Damage. Originally a military term, collateral damage describes any death, injury, or other damage inflicted that is an incidental result of some activity, or I would add, inactivity. Unlike other military jargon, this idea has taken root in our language and our imaginations, and we use it to describe all sorts of things. You know, I sprayed a little weed killer over there and those flowers died, a collateral damage. Sometimes we just accept that there are losses we can't help. It's interesting. Gaffney writes, while Jews socialize Israel and their heroes like David, womanist, feminist, and post-colonial readers advocate for reading from the position of the most marginalized. Here, they are David's victims, reading from the bottom up. This is what Howard Thurman calls the gospel of the oppressed, God's preferential option for the poor, God's concern for the vulnerable. When David finds himself the victim of violence and theft, the giant slayer makes a deal to ally himself with his enemies. He and his men become mercenaries, fighting for money. To prove their loyalty, they go on this raid, and they steal not just clothing, not just riches, but people. And in this case, they don't just steal, they kill. Neither woman nor man did David leave to be brought back to Gath, it says in verse 11. There's an old adage that says, dead men tell no tales.
lest someone return to Saul and say, David, David and his men came and massacred us in his camp. David kills every living person. Now, there are better art historians in our congregation than me, but I don't remember seeing that in any of the Renaissance paintings. You know, David's genocidal revenge doesn't come up in the Michelangelo library of works. But again, there are those who are more powerful who are trying to entrap David. He is responsible, but he is not alone in the responsibility. Achish believes that he owns David. It says at the end of the passage that he is making David a stench in the nostrils of his own people. But crafty David is not totally indiscriminate. He is careful to not attack his own people. He's only attacking the people attached to the tribe of Judah, Saul's relations. David is careful to choose the common enemies so that he will be innocent in the eyes of his own people. I read this story and I come away just with this sense that war is a terrible, terrible thing. It leaves very few innocent because bombs go astray, landmines left for an enemy are found years later by the children of that community. Soldiers grow sick from toxic fumes, and there will always be collateral damage. Regrettable yet acceptable losses, we say. The real crisis, though, is that we become numb to this idea. We become numb to the numbers and statistics. And frankly, we'd rather not know. As I was getting our kids ready for school this week, this was our first week back at school. We were packing backpacks and lunches and making sure they had all the supplies they needed. I came across a story about the children of Ukraine still trying to go to school even in the midst of an active conflict. Teachers who were trying to teach remotely. Students who were trying to learn remotely. And I came across the horrible statistic that over 1,500 children have died because of this conflict. And at first, you know what I thought? That seems like a rather small number. For how long this has gone on and the destruction that it has wrought. And as I was, you know, thinking of our children, I was just overwhelmed by the depth of this conflict and how little I've thought of it or prayed about it. Now, throughout history, poems and songs have been sung about the unfortunate victims of war. Still, men and sometimes women plot war expecting collateral damage. Even in peacetime, our leaders create policies that leave millions of refugees shivering in camps, drowning in the sea, or fainting in the desert. We create laws that strip the vulnerable of their rights and freedoms, condemning them to a life of poverty. And it's not just the human toil. There's an impact on our world, on the earth, and all of its life. That, too, is treated as collateral damage. I remember reading stories about the Iraq War and the burn pits that were there, and the oil that was just lit a fire. It's devastating. We cannot become numb to these things. We cannot imagine that it's okay, that there's ever an acceptable amount of collateral damage. But this is the way of empire, of striving for world dominance, of becoming enamored with technological progress and economic stimulus and wealth creation. We accept that there is acceptable loss. And every statistic that we read hides the fact that there's an individual. There's a person with a name.
and a story, that there's a place that was once sacred or precious to a creature or to a people. Everyone has a name that God knows. Brings me back to Ahinoam and Abigail. Now, they were treated as living, breathing collateral damage. Not much is known about Ahinoam. Some scholars suggest that she is actually one of Saul's older wives that he gave to David to, again, reinforce this connection to his family. Ahinoam is listed as the mother of David's oldest son. She is caught up in the drama, in the conflict that is David's story. We know little more than her name. Abigail is described here still as the wife of Nabal. Remind me, did I talk about Abigail before? She is described not as David's wife, but as the wife of Nabal, even here, because of her story. See, earlier in the account, David and his men had set off to rob a wealthy man named Nabal. But Nabal is so stubborn that he would rather that every man, woman, and child in his camp be slaughtered than be forced to give David's men even a loaf of bread. So he says, "I will die first." Abigail says, "Oh, hello, over here. I'd prefer not to die, thank you." And so she goes and very shrewdly makes a peace offering to David and his men, brings out food and riches, and pleads with him, "Don't do this thing. Don't attack our camp." And so David notices that she is beautiful and that she has made this offering and relents. Decides that's enough of a shakedown for that day. And she lives for another day. And then mysteriously, Nabal dies soon after. And David and his men go back. Hero, we would like him to be. He is, in fact, much more like the world leaders that we see today. Flawed, complicated, far from innocent. And his is a cautionary tale about how patriarchy mixed with power can create this unending cycle of violence and destruction. Our scriptures are full, in fact, of these tragic stories. And yet, I do not believe a good and loving God approves of us treating anyone or anything as collateral damage. God did not sanction this. Even if the story says so. My God did not sanction this violence against man, woman, and child. Jesus of Nazareth speaks about the vulnerable, and the disempowered, and the marginalized. And under the umbrella of widows and orphans and strangers and prisoners, in Matthew 25, he says, "Do unto the least of these as you would unto me." He says, for our inaction, there is judgment. But for our action, there is blessing. He says to me, we don't have to accept Achish's deal. We don't have to accept collateral damage as the norm for our lives, for our world. We have the power to make better choices, to consider who and what we allow ourselves to treat as expendable. Jesus shows us a better way. Especially in regard to the little ones. I knew I couldn't just leave you with that passage from 1 Samuel. I had to pair it with something else. And so I shared this passage from Matthew's Gospel that talks about God's love and attention toward the little ones. I don't know if that's literal, but I love the idea that there are angels sitting before God, reminding God of the children in our midst. I love that image because it reminds me that God is always paying attention to the vulnerable, to the small, to those who are left uncared for. Jesus shows us a better way. What he shows us is that right living begins in the heart. It begins right here, in how we think about ourselves and how we live in this world, the decisions we make. David was thinking only of his immediate needs, his own survival, his own glory. He had little concern for those who might be affected by his decisions. There was no weeping over the loss of life. There was no struggle over the impact upon these women so closely connected to him. But later on, throughout his story, we do see an image of a repentant heart. That's the grace in his story. We do see a humble and contrite heart in his prayer to God. It reminds me that we have a choice each and every day. That out of our heart, we breathe life. We can breathe life. But we face that dilemma each and every day. We make ethical and moral choices in about everything we do. I go to the grocery store and I think about the things I'm putting in my cart. And I'm thinking, is this a moral purchase? Think about the things I wear. Is it fast fashion? I'm not really into fast fashion, but I think about the people impacted in the factories that are making those clothes. I think about the people breathing the air from the cars that I drive. Think about how we travel, how we vote. It gets a little overwhelming at times, doesn't it? You can drive yourself crazy thinking, is this the best right choice? All I know is that we have power to choose. And we know that a law, a decision, a policy that might affect us, well, negatively affecting someone else or something else in this world, God's creation, if we choose only from our own selfish needs and wants, that's not right. We can do better. As Maya Angelou says, when we know better, you do better. We know we cannot think only of ourselves. We must also think of the generations to come. We must think of the vulnerable, those who are marginalized in our societies. We must remember that God cares about those that the rest of the world deems collateral damage. God cares about them, and we should too. The love of neighbor calls us to care for all life, all people, all God's children. So may we learn our lessons well from these stories, from the lessons of the past, and may we choose life. Amen.